Venezuela's dictator is gone, but its dictatorship remains. How will President Trump and the diaspora here rectify that? And the U is back, one win away from it all. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we're going to unpack what's happened in Venezuela since that stunning U.S. Special Forces operation that captured dictator Nicolas Maduro early last Saturday. What is the Trump administration's plan now for restoring democracy as Venezuela's regime holdovers order new repression? What about Maria Corina Machado, or is this just about oil? And we'll also look at the return of University of Miami football to national prominence. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. If you have friends and family in Venezuela, you were probably woken up around 2 a.m. last Saturday morning by text messages or WhatsApp calls alerting you with videos of explosions like these rocking the capital, Caracas. Before sunrise, we'd learned that U.S. Special Forces had arrested Venezuelan dictator Nicolas Maduro from his bunker and were whisking him to New York to face drug trafficking conspiracy charges. It was a stunning operation, but it left behind a sobering reality. Venezuela's brutal socialist dictator was gone, but its brutal socialist dictatorship remained. President Trump claimed the U.S. was now running Venezuela and that Maduro's number two, now acting President Delcy Rodriguez, would hand over its oil reserves, the world's largest. Meanwhile, as Trump pointedly sidelined Venezuela's opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, the holdover regime mounted a repressive crackdown in the streets, leaving Venezuelans to wonder when and if democracy will ever be restored there. We'd, of course, like to know your thoughts on this controversial drama, especially if you have ties to Venezuela yourself. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio is Venezuelan expat Elena Poleo. She's president of Influence Communications here in Miami and part of a family of journalists who fled regime persecution in Venezuela. Also with us is Brian Fonseca. He's director of the Gordon Institute for Public Policy at Florida International University and a Venezuela expert. Elena Poleo, I want to start with you here because I know that you, like me and my wife, were jolted out of bed early last Saturday morning by alarms from Venezuela. What did you at first think was happening? And when did you realize what actually had happened? And what was your initial reaction as a Venezuelan exile when it all sunk in?
Well, Tim, as you know, it was in the wee hours of the morning on Saturday. Yeah. So I had actually my birthday was January 2nd.
Feliz cumpleaños.
Gracias. We were just getting to bed, actually. And my husband and I, we were turning on the TV, just kind of unwinding. And then my phone rings and it's a family member in Venezuela. And I picked up the phone and he tells me, está pasando. Llegaron los gringos.
It's happening. Yeah.
It's happening. The gringos have arrived.
Yeah.
And I was like, what are you talking about? And I heard a bomb go off.
Yeah.
In the distance. It wasn't close, but, and I said, what is that? He goes, those are bombs. And then my husband's phone started, who's also Venezuelan, started mm-hmm. going off. And well, we didn't sleep very much that night. And at first, it was a lot of confusion. And when the images started coming in, I could see that that it was American choppers. And we said, okay, so it's the Americans, but what is happening?
Mm-hmm.
At 4-ish in the morning, we heard that they had taken Maduro. And there was such a surge of hope and happiness that we all started crying.
Yeah.
And as the day progressed on Saturday, the view was very different.
Yeah, it changed. Brian Fonseca, you're a Venezuela expert, but also a military expert. You're a former Marine. And I know when you and I first spoke early Saturday morning, there were some things that stood out for you about what you were seeing and hearing from Caracas. What made this U.S. raid so extraordinary to you, both militarily and legally?
I mean, from a military, well, first off, Tim, thanks so much for having me. This is one of the most consequential, acts of American military muscle in the Western Hemisphere since the Cold War. And I think what made this, I mean, just the military operation itself so exceptional is two things I'll point out. One, the incredible work of the U.S. intelligence community that has been going on for months, if not longer, in order to build the kind of intelligence packets that would lead to a successful military operation inside Venezuela against an incredible, you know, sophisticated, you know, set of you know, potential challenges in terms of trying to go and extract, you know, someone, and in this case, Nicolas
Maduro. Right, so those Chinook helicopters knew exactly where to go in Caracas.
They knew exactly where to go. And I mean, they could, and here's where the complexity of the military operation itself was. These helicopters were able to come from ship, you know, across, you know, the Caribbean into Venezuelan land territory, so airspace, and then overland, get on the ground and get into the room to capture Maduro and his wife before they had a chance to be secured in some other room, and work their way past what now amount to, you know, dozens of adversarial threats that they had to neutralize in the process. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was incredible. And this was also a really complex multi-domain operation. Yeah. It wasn't just air, land, sea, but it was also cyber, right? The cyber attacks on the city to bring the
because,
city
because the lights
down.
Went the lights went out in Caracas before this
and
all
the
happened.
Internet
yeah.
went off.
Yeah.
Right. It's the lights went out and the internet went off. And I mean, all of that mm-hmm. and that, by the way, started to undermine command and control centers.
Right.
Then you had EMP attacks, right, against Russian anti-aircraft vehicles that were on the ground there to repel.
Which is why we didn't see so much surface to air missile fire against this operation that one might have expected the Venezuelan military to fire, right?
That's exactly right. So, yeah. I mean, just the overall work that went into it was just incredible.
But Brian, legally, what stands out for you in terms of the precedent this might be setting in terms of going in and arresting a sovereign head of state this way, as we saw Saturday morning?
Yeah, I mean, there are two, you know, seemingly dug in positions on this. The first position is that the United States breached another country's territorial sovereignty and removed the head of state and extracted that head of state back to the United States. And what kind of precedence does that set, especially against a geopolitical backdrop where, of course, China is looking at Taiwan, you know, Russia continues its incursions in Eastern Europe. And so that is the concern around, precedence. The other side is saying the United States went in and captured an illegitimate leader, that Maduro was not the legitimate president of Venezuela, head of state, because he was displaced in elections last year. Mm-hmm. And then he was a criminal that they had to go in and serve American justice to. And those are
not just a criminal, but a narco-terrorist.
Why the military was supporting and what the administration said was a law enforcement. And that's to help them get around some of the legal barriers, by the way.
Exactly. Elena, we've had a week to digest this. So describe the sort of split screen emotions the Venezuelan diaspora is dealing with this week, which you were starting to allude to earlier. I mean, I was there in Doral, or Doralzuela, before the sun came up last Saturday as Venezuelans gathered at El Aripaso to celebrate the news of Maduro's ouster. But I've also been talking with them on the phone this week about their growing fears now that they might be celebrating too soon. Can you walk us through what Venezuelans are processing right now?
Well, that's exactly right. At first, it was very, very exciting. We were filled with hope. But then we realized that maybe Maduro is gone, but his regime remains. Mm-hmm. His vice president is now president. And actually, she still calls Maduro the leader. Yeah. So it's not like, you know, it's not like he's gone. And Delcy Rodriguez, who is now the president of Venezuela, mm-hmm. has always been part of all of the crimes, all of the persecutions, all of the tortures against journalists and opposition leaders and members of the military who stand up and voice their opinion against the government. So really, in reality and practicality, nothing has changed. And that is very painful for Venezuelans to see that they finally took Maduro and yet everything remains the same.
But Elena, we should mention that yesterday the Maduro's successor regime, including Delcy Rodriguez, did release some of the almost 900 political prisoners in Venezuela. But does that indicate that Delcy Rodriguez and the regime cabal are willing to move toward actual regime change, do you think?
I don't think so, because they have done this before.
Yeah.
They have released prisoners. Which
did it under the Biden administration.
That's right.
Yeah.
They have done this before, and they said, oh, this is going to be a step towards, you know, unification and peace. They said they were going to release a large number. Up to today, they've released nine.
Yeah. Or could have been, I think, maybe 11. I don't know. I
well,
saw that.
Well, last I checked, and again.
But still, you're talking about 11 out of almost 900.
Exactly. Yes, so yes, that's not a large number of prisoners.
Right. Brian, what's your take on this political prisoner gesture by the regime yesterday?
No, and I mean, I think Elena's right. I mean, yeah, in part, I think here's the challenge. I mean, the challenge fundamentally is that the U.S. is doing two things that it hasn't done before. One, it has used the military force to go into Venezuela and capture someone indicted in American justice. And there are two other really important figures in the equation
yeah.
that have that same threat looming over their head. And
right.
that's Diosdado Cabello
and Vladimir Padrino. And I want to get to those a little
right.
later. But first, Brian, I want to remind our listeners how prescient you were early last Saturday morning, because I remember asking you what you thought was going to happen now that Maduro was gone. And you advised me that when what we were probably going to see was the Trump administration, quote, handing the keys to Delcy Rodriguez for a stabilization period, end quote, and that this could end up being more about oil than regime change. And hours later, President Trump stepped up to the mic at Mar-a-Lago and pretty much confirmed your hunches. Walk us through briefly the Trump administration's thinking about how this is all supposed to play out moving forward, oil and otherwise.
Yeah, and I think that, again, Trump validated that certainly oil was at the top of the priority list for American interests. But I also think the administration is looking at oil as a means of essentially influencing political outcomes on the ground. I mean, the mm-hmm. challenge we've had in Venezuela for a long time now is that we've had no influence, no levers of influence on the ground to shape political outcomes. Now, you have the military is now a credible threat. Right. That wasn't the case in Trump 1.0. It wasn't on the table for the Biden administration. Mm-hmm. The military is now a credible threat. That's number one.
Meaning the U.S. military.
The U.S. military.
Right.
Yes. Number two is that you have the embargo, which is the enforcement of the sanctions, which we haven't done before either. And again, Venezuela's government will rely on two things to survive: proceeds from oil and proceeds from illicit trafficking. And I think the administration is trying to
right.
to strangle them economically and essentially run the Trump administration's comments about run the country is through their
right.
control over the economic levers of the country.
Right. And when you say embargo, I just want to say, so embargo, when you mention embargo, that means the sort of the blockade that people have been seeing in
sorry,
the news
sorry,
so much.
Yeah.
yeah. So, but
yes,
I have to move here for Brian. I wanted to ask Elena then, given all that, what's obviously thrown everyone here in South Florida, however, out of kilter is the rather astonishing remark President Trump made at Mar-a-Lago when he asserted that the leader of Venezuela's democratic opposition, Nobel Peace Prize winner Maria Corina Machado, does not have enough support or respect in Venezuela to lead the country.
Well, I think it would be very tough for her to be the leader. She doesn't have the support within or the respect within the country. She's a very nice woman, but she doesn't have the respect.
So, Elena, on the one hand, I think most people agree it's reasonable for the Trump administration to temporarily hand the reins to regime holdovers like Delcy Rodriguez for a time to ensure stability as you set your sights on regime change and the restoration of democracy. But by undercutting Machado that way, he seemed to in turn undercut the prospects of regime change and democracy restoration. How do you think that's going down here and inside Venezuela?
That came as a massive shock to the Venezuelan community here in South Florida and the opposition within Venezuela. Maria Corina Machado is held as the leader of the opposition. She is almost wholly to the opposition at this point.
Yeah.
And to undermine her that way publicly, right when you're having the press conference about what occurred on Saturday morning, was just a massive blow. And I think that shows us that it is exactly about oil and it is not about regime change. And that is the truth. Now, we do know that Maria Corina Machado will be going
right.
to Washington, D.C. next week. And President Trump has said that he looks forward to meeting with her because she's a very nice woman, is what he said.
Right.
But, you know, we don't really know because what we do know is that it is about oil. He made it very clear in the press conference.
Yeah. And Brian, I think. Yeah. So go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, I think that I think there is some truth to that. But I think the prospects of regime change are more in the midterm. I mean, at the end of the day, the challenge is that handing the opposition essentially the country at a time where the institutions, and I think what President Trump was saying was that the institutions don't trust the opposition.
Right.
And the institutions
especially,
that matter,
especially
the military.
Right. Especially the military.
And this is the fundamental problem, that you could have a scenario where the country devolves into civil conflict if a new empowered opposition comes in and the institutions fight for survival. That's the fundamental challenge that is going to stop any type of regime.
Yeah, no, exactly. And that's why I said I think a lot of people find it reasonable that you do hand the reins to regime holdovers like Rodriguez to create a modicum of stability before you start moving forward in those areas. I agree with you. But Brian, I think a lot of folks feel the big news out of Venezuela this week after the Maduro arrest wasn't the regime's rather modest political prisoner release, but rather this scary regime crackdown with goons stopping people on the streets to check their cell phones for any evidence that they supported or celebrated Maduro's ouster. You mentioned there are other figures besides Rodriguez in this regime cabal. There's her brother Jorge, the National Assembly President, Defense Minister Vladimir Padrino, and perhaps the scariest one of them all, Interior Minister Diosdado Cabello. Do you think they have any intention of allowing democratic regime change to occur there?
You did an exceptional piece on Delcy, and there have been some other reports on Diosdado and others. And I think here's the challenge is that right now the White House is saying, Delcy, it is your responsibility, right? We're telling you that it's your responsibility to get the hardliners either neutralized or removed, right? We're going to control the economy. We're going to keep the threat of military off the coast, and we are going to push through you to try to manage the hardliners in a way that we can begin to moderate them and start to move towards the regime change by holding elections, et cetera. I think that, and again, I'm not saying it's going to work or it's going to fail, but I think if you're trying to interpret what the White House is doing, oil is in the national interest. That's what the president said. Regime change is certainly in the State Department's interest. They've been stating that for a long time. And I think it's about all of these things coming together and getting the country in a position where it's moving back. You need hardliners to move away from this hard position of regime survival, or else the country will devolve in civil war when these two forces meet in the future. And so I think that's the challenge. That's Delcy's challenge. I think that was going to be the hardest to get out of the way.
Sure.
As
I said, he's the scariest of them all. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Venezuelan expat communications consultant Elena Poleo and Florida International University Venezuela expert Brian Fonseca about the stunning U.S. military ouster of Venezuelan dictator Nicolas Maduro and how the Trump administration plans to get rid of the Venezuelan dictatorship that's still there. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Elena Poleo, I want to keep for a minute on that theme of whether Delcy Rodriguez and the other hardline regime holdovers really are working behind the scenes with the Trump administration to pave the way towards, say, new democratic elections that Machado and the opposition would likely win, or if their end game is actually, as Brian just noted, regime survival. You, your father, your brother were journalists persecuted by the regime. You know its Machiavellian mindset. What do you think is going
survival.
On?
Survival. They're going for survival. I don't think it is in their bingo card to change, have a regime change. They want to find a way that Delcy and them can work with the American government, give them what they want, which is the oil revenue, and still maintain their power and still maintain their status of life. They've stolen millions and millions of dollars, and they have made it through as well, drug trafficking. But they want to maintain their power and they want to maintain their level of life for them and their families. Mm-hmm. So that is what they want to do. If that is just survival and maintaining a kind of quasi Chavista regime with friendship.
Chavista referring to Hugo Chavez,
which
founder of the revolution.
It's still called Chavista regime.
Sure, exactly.
The Chavista regime quasi with friendliness to the United States in an economic way, and that will make Trump happy because he can get the oil that he wants and the American companies can come in, not just Chevron, which is the only one that is allowed there, but every other oil company can come in, then I can see that this can go on for a long time.
But Brian Fonseca, I just wanted to ask you, Brian, what happens if Rodriguez and the regime don't play ball with Trump when it comes to oil or regime change? Vladimir Padrino and Diosdado Cabello seem key in that regard because they control, as you pointed out, the all-important military apparatus in Venezuela. So if they keep holding out, will Trump have to order a new military strike to dislodge them?
Yeah, and just real one clarification, Maduro was going to give the Americans oil too. Remember, there are sanctions that keep us off the off the field. And I think, again, there were lots of reporting that Maduro was willing to negotiate with the Americans over oil too.
Right, there was that meeting in Qatar, for example.
So I think the Americans could have gotten the oil, even leaving Maduro in, but not to regime change because the regime survival. I think this was a forced fracture in Venezuela. Now the political elite are all vying for position. They're either going to consolidate or they're going to further fracture. And to your point, if Delcy doesn't move in line, then you know they're going to look for somebody else. But you could see another military incursion.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to imagine Diosdado Cabello was like, if this can happen to Maduro, it can happen to me too. And I think that's the point of this. That's what's trying to force the hardliners to moderate, to either get out of the way, go into exile, go to jail. Or they're going to moderate and you're going to start to see some concessions. Again, the prospect of regime change is not overnight. It's one of those things that are looking 12, 18 months down the road, but they got to get the conditions
right. But if these holdouts don't cooperate in order to bring down the regime and the military that supports it completely, would it take a full-blown U.S. military invasion, if not occupation, to bring democracy back in that scenario?
It could, and that would be the worst case for the Americans because that would force us on the ground for a pronounced period of time. I think you might see another surgical strike like you saw on Saturday to go after a Diosdado Cabello, for example, or a Padrino Lopez. And at the end of the day, I think that the U.S. has demonstrated it's willing to go into Venezuela in pursuit of its interests. And I think the interests are inclusive of regime change. It's just that's not in the cards right now.
Yeah. Helena, finally, we can't ignore another more domestic facet to all of this, and that's the Trump administration's argument that since they've removed Maduro, Venezuela is now safe and promising to return to, which events on the ground there this week obviously contradict or would seem to contradict. Does the diaspora here buy into Trump's argument that this means the cancellation of temporary protected status, or TPS, for more than 500,000 Venezuelan migrants, which would mean deporting them back to Venezuela, is justified? Does the diaspora here buy that?
No, they do not. They do not buy it. Everybody has either a friend or a family member that was here under TPS. And also they eliminated the refugee program that the Biden administration had started. Right now there was a lot of confusion as to what they can do and what they can hope for. But I can tell you that Venezuela is in no way safe and prosperous at this point. Repression has increased this past week. More journalists have been jailed. More people that had allegedly celebrated what had happened to Maduro have been jailed. So it is definitely not safe by any stretch of the imagination.
All right. And Brian, finally, in the minute or so that we just have left here, what about the bigger geopolitical picture, namely the concern that what just happened in Venezuela has emboldened Trump to double down on his so-called Don Roe doctrine insistence that the Western Hemisphere belongs to the U.S., and therefore he has the right to arrest Latin American leaders he doesn't like and annex territory he wants, like Greenland? I mean, from your standpoint as an analyst of this, is the U.S. headed in a risky direction here?
I mean, certainly it is heading in a direction where it could continue to, drive a wedge between us and allies across the Western Hemisphere. And I think that's important to note. So the U.S. does have to be careful at how it engages Venezuela. It can't do the same. I don't think the U.S. is going to send the military into Colombia. I think the president's dead serious about Greenland, but it's going to be economic and political coercion to try to get Denmark to sell Greenland. I don't think the U.S. is sending the military. I think Cuba and Nicaragua have to be more concerned about a more aggressive U.S. offensive to displace those regimes. I think, Secretary Rubio is really passionate about them. But I do think that the United States is pursuing, proactive coercion as part of its statecraft. It's dismissing multilateralism. It's going direct. And it's putting interests over values as it continues to engage the Western Hemisphere in pursuit of what they call strategic denial. Yeah. Right. This idea of denying American adversaries access to the Western Hemisphere.
Right. Brian Fonseca is director of Florida International University's Gordon Institute of Public Policy. Venezuelan expat and former journalist Helena Poleo is president of Influence Communications in Miami. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Still to come, we'll speak to an analyst on the ground in Caracas about where the situation there looks headed. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. We're continuing our Venezuela crisis discussion now with Phil Gunson. He's a respected Latin America veteran and senior Venezuela analyst for the nonprofit International Crisis Group. Phil always brings a dose of realism to the debate over how to restore democracy to Venezuela, and that's particularly welcome now, particularly in an exile community like South Florida's, when expectations for regime change have been sharply raised after last Saturday's U.S. military ouster of dictator Nicolas Maduro. Phil Gunson joins me now from Caracas. Phil, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Tim. It's a pleasure to be with you, and thank you for calling me a realist. Some people call me a pessimist.
In journalism, I think the two are the same thing.
Well, you know what they say, that a pessimist is only a well-informed optimist.
Good. You're right. I first just want to get your appraisal of the mood and the scene there on the ground in Caracas this week, especially as we here try to reconcile, on the one hand, the regime's release of some political prisoners yesterday, but on the other hand, the jolting regime crackdown on the population there, especially the hunt for evidence on people's phones, for example, that they supported Nicolas Maduro's ouster by the U.S. military. Do we still have Phil? Phil?
Yes, I'm still here. Okay. I think we lost each other briefly.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. No, I'm just, again, you know, that trying to reconcile those two things, the prisoners' release, but yet the regime crackdown. What's the mood like there?
Yeah, I mean, the mood here, I think, is, I suppose, cautiously optimistic after yesterday's releases. But the releases really were very disappointing in the light of what Jorge Rodriguez, the president of the National Assembly, one of the leading figures in the regime here, and obviously the brother of Delcy Rodriguez, who's now the president.
Right.
I mean, Jorge Rodriguez had said that, significant numbers, I think was the term he
used. An important number, right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
An important number. I mean, it's not an important number. It's less than a dozen so far. And of course, there are more in the pipeline, but this idea that there was going to be a mass release doesn't seem to be actually what's happening. And of course, I think, the interpretation about what's going on has to be that people in the government, and most especially the hardliners in the government, particularly perhaps those linked to the security forces, are very keen that nobody should get the idea that there's a political opening here.
Yeah.
Because I think they fear that might turn into some kind of snowball effect.
Yeah, and all that obviously informed a new analysis that you and the International Crisis Group released just this morning called Venezuela After Maduro, Transaction or Transition? Tell us specifically, Phil, what you mean by transaction or transition.
Well, to put it, I suppose, in the bluntest possible terms, Donald Trump seems to be delighted with the idea that Venezuela is going to hand over all its oil. And in passing, he mentions that, by the way, maybe we restore democracy. So I think for Trump, as you might imagine, the democracy and human rights part seems to be less interesting to him, at least, than grabbing the oil. Now, that may be, too cynical a take on it. I think there are other people in the administration, and particularly Secretary of State Rubio, who are very focused on the idea of a political transition.
Right. And we should point out he put out a 3-point presentation this week, which he claims would lead to democratic restoration or transition in Venezuela.
That's correct. And it's encouraging to see that. It's a lot more detailed is perhaps not the word, but it's a lot more coherent than a lot of things that we've seen coming out of Washington. But of course, there's no timeline. And
yeah.
And the other thing that I want to say, Tim, is that there's no participation by the opposition, who, of course, represent the vast bulk of Venezuelans. Venezuelans voted in 2024 massively for a change, not just a simple change of government, a change of regime.
Right, which brings me to the point that the Crisis Group report that you released this morning makes it clear that, quote, This sort of transition must not be confused with demands from Venezuelan opposition leaders and constituencies in Trump's Republican Party for instant regime change in Caracas. Now, from where I sit here in Miami, of course, I was struck by that because it seems a warning to the Venezuelan opposition and especially the Venezuelan diaspora here. Not only that it will likely have to temper its expectations for regime change, but that it may have placed too heavy a bet on President Trump to deliver regime change. What's the more sobering reality here to your mind?
Well, I think it's very understandable that people in the Venezuelan diaspora and people here in Venezuela too want instant change. Why would they not? They've seen their country, you know, politically and economically go, you know, I mean, the politics, the democratic institutions have been dismantled, the economy has collapsed, millions of people have had to leave the country. Why would they not want instant change? Problem is that from the point of view of a practicality, of reality on the ground, instant change could lead to violent chaos. And that's the simple truth. And in that regard, the Trump administration was, I think, right. It's not been popular, of course, here but or outside, but was right to avoid simply trying to slot in an opposition government after removing the entirety of the Maduro government.
Yeah. Now, your crisis group analysis puts a particular focus on Trump's assertion that the now acting regime president, Delcy Rodriguez, who had been vice president, if not the regime altogether, will, quote, do whatever the U.S. needs now post-Maduro. But you warn that there may well be some naivete on the Trump administration's part here, especially when, as you point out, when there's no physical U.S. presence on the ground there in Venezuela to enforce that.
That's right. Even as we speak, actually, there are U.S. officials here, including apparently the U.S. acting ambassador in Colombia, McNamara, who are here looking at how to reopen the U.S. embassy, which has been closed since 2019.
Right.
But there's no embassy so far. There are no troops on the ground. And this is an unprecedented attempt by a foreign country to determine the outcome of a political and economic transition without really having any significant presence on the ground.
Yeah. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Latin America veteran and senior Venezuela analyst for the nonprofit International Crisis Group, Phil Gunson. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Phil, I go back to something you told me when we spoke early Saturday morning after U.S. Special Forces had just whisked Nicolas Maduro out of Venezuela. And it was a twofold question that you were presenting, really. One, has socialist hardliner and now acting president Delcy Rodriguez really become this regime moderate the Trump administration seems to believe in recent years, who's now willing to hand Venezuela's oil wealth and its commonwealth over to the U.S.? And two, even if she is, does she really exercise enough control inside the regime hierarchy there to get the hardliners who control the military and security forces, namely Defense Minister Vladimir Padrino and Interior Minister Diosdado Cabello, to come along with all of that?
Yeah, I think you raise what is one of the most important questions in this whole scenario. I mean, first of all, Delcy Rodriguez is not a moderate. She's not a political moderate.
No.
She may be pragmatic on the economic front.
Yeah.
But she's not a moderate. She told me that herself on one occasion, the only time I was actually able to ask her a question. But at the same time, she's more of a pragmatist, more likely to be able to act as an interlocutor with Washington in contrast with those who with the guys with the guns, basically, you know, the defense minister, the interior minister, who between them control the security forces and are very reluctant to see any kind of political opening. So she has to act. She has to carry out this kind of balancing act between the demands of Washington and what's feasible here, what kind of consensus she can reach with the other people in government.
But is there any way that Delcy Rodriguez can convince hardliners like Vladimir Padrino and Diosdado Cabello that, you know, the path we're on here is eventually to give up power and hand it over to someone they despise, meaning Maria Corina Machado and the Democratic opposition?
I think the short answer to that is no. And I don't think she wants that either, or her brother Jorge, the chair of the National Assembly, the Venezuelan parliament. They don't want that, but they're trying to figure out what they can get away with. In other words, if they go partway along this route that the United States seems to be tracing out for them, will that be good enough? What, how about if they drag their feet? How about if they say yes but don't actually do it? In the classic, as you'll recall, the classic sort of Latin American historical phrase of I obey but I don't comply, or I comply but I don't carry out the orders.
Right. Or what the Mexicans always said, as you remember when you and I were both living in Mexico City, what the Mexicans always said was, tell the Americans yes, but never when.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly the point. I mean, I'm sure that's what they have in mind. The question is, what will the US administration do about that? Will they, if the foot dragging starts, and if, if it becomes clear that it's not going the way the US wants, what will the US response be? According to Marco Rubio, they're going to fine-tune the pressure by deciding how much oil they allow Venezuela to sell on the
Sure.
international market, for example.
But then there's the question that brings up of how serious Trump himself really is about pushing regime change and democracy's restoration, especially after he dissed opposition leader Maria Corina Machado last weekend. Along those lines, Phil, your analysis earlier this week cautioned that with Maduro's ouster, Trump may just want to declare mission accomplished and therefore not have to put all that much energy into the final result everyone here and in the Venezuelan opposition wants, which is actual regime change. What's your counsel as to just how serious Trump himself is about regime change?
We heard from senior administration officials constantly throughout the first half of last year. Trump was not remotely interested in regime change. And of course, I mean, I think there's certainly a potential scenario in which Trump and perhaps Delcy Rodriguez or whoever might succeed her come to the conclusion that they can do a perfectly good pragmatic deal that has to do with oil and migration and drug trafficking and so on, without introducing any kind of political opening at all. But I think Secretary of State Rubio has another idea, a different idea.
Yeah,
And of course, it's
because,
easier for Trump than it is for Rubio in that regard.
yeah, no, and I'm glad you bring up Rubio again, because obviously his agenda isn't just Venezuelan regime change, but utilizing Venezuelan regime change to trigger regime change in Cuba and Nicaragua, etc., no?
For sure, this is not just about Venezuela, and it's not even just about leftist regimes in the Caribbean, around the Caribbean basin. It's about sending a message to the entire region, if not the world, that as I think Trump told the New York Times just yesterday, if what are the guardrails here? What are the boundaries? What is it that you cannot do internationally? And basically, he doesn't think there are any. So, what is the region going to do? How is the world going to adapt to a government that's now emboldened by what happened in Venezuela to possibly move on other countries, other issues elsewhere, like, for example, Mexican drug cartels or the Colombian guerrillas?
Now, and finally, your crisis group report today points out that so far the Trump administration, including that three-point Venezuela plan Secretary of State Marco Rubio presented this week, quote, appears largely focused on extracting the country's oil instead of engaging in what you call the comprehensive negotiating that's going to have to be done to phase out the dictatorship and usher in opposition leaders like Edmundo González, the candidate who actually defeated Maduro in the 2024 presidential election. At the end of the day, then, Phil, do you feel that this is more about oil than about democracy, and that's how we should really be looking at it?
I think it's more about oil in Trump's mind. That's my sense.
Okay.
But I don't think that that's necessarily the case for everybody else in the administration. Even beyond the State Department and Marco Rubio, there's a whole bunch of issues here. Some are focused on combating drug cartels, some are focused on migration. But overall, I think where they come together is that they want to reassert US power. Trump thinks it's about oil, but I think that's a rather old-fashioned
Yeah.
way to look at it. The US doesn't really need Venezuelan oil all that badly.
No. And nor was Venezuela really a prime source of drugs coming into the United States, which was the other pretext for this whole operation, correct?
Indeed, yeah, no, that's absolutely true. I think there've been there've been a lot of hyperbole and a lot of false stories that have been told in the build-up to this episode. But the reality is that Maduro was a soft target in a sense. I mean, Maduro is a guy who's repudiated at home and abroad. Somebody, nobody really, or very, very few people are shedding any tears, seeing him behind bars.
No, that's a good point to end with. Phil Gunson is senior Venezuela analyst in Caracas for the International Crisis Group. Phil, many thanks. We really appreciate it.
You're very welcome, Tim.
Still to come, the U is back and on its way to the national championship. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Okay, put the tips of your thumbs together and make a big U with your hands.
Carson Beck with his legs puts Miami on top.
With 18 seconds left in the Fiesta Bowl last night, University of Miami Hurricanes quarterback Carson Beck scampered into the end zone for the winning touchdown against Ole Miss, as you just heard ESPN call it there. It sent UM into the college football national championship on January 19th, here on its home field at Hard Rock Stadium. But the Canes' comeback was also emblematic of the two decades-long comeback of the U's once legendary football program. Or I should say legendary but not always reputable. That has changed in a big way. Under Coach Mario Cristobal, UM Football 2.0 is not known for the controversies that plagued the program in the 1980s and 90s alongside the national championships. Either way, the U is back. Joining me now is Patrick Previti. He's a football sideline reporter for ESPN Plus and an expert for Canes Warning, a website about University of Miami Hurricane sports. Patrick, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, man. Thank you for having me.
If you're a Canes football fan, we'd like to hear from you, too. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Patrick, I want to go back to that winning moment we just played from last night, Hurricanes quarterback Carson Beck's touchdown. His heroics reminded old guys like me of the famous UM quarterbacks of those 1980s and 90s days, like Vinny Testaverde, Jim Kelly, Bernie Kosar. Do you think Beck, especially if UM wins the national championship, could be placed in that pantheon? And if so, why do you think it's been so long since UM has had a quarterback of that caliber?
Well, I think anytime you can win a national championship and bring a national championship back to a storied program such as Miami, you're going to have to automatically put him probably with those guys.
Uh-huh.
Now, first, before I kind of get into the second part, it definitely, I would be remiss from mentioning Cam Ward as well. I mean, imagine this team with Cam Ward mm-hmm. from last year. Obviously, yeah. the defense wasn't exactly frightening opposing offenses. So he should also kind of get a little bit of a mention. But yes, for Carson Beck, man, knock on wood a little bit here for those Miami fans. But certainly he would have to be with those guys. And especially if he plays in the national championship the same way he did against Ole Miss, where
right.
it's not just him not turning over the ball. It's him kind of being a contributor to the winning, to the offensive output.
Right.
That would, I think, also gain him a ton of respect. And right. then looking ahead, because, you know, you can't really answer too much about, you know, UM trying to find a quarterback of that caliber, especially since now things have completely changed. I would say Miami is now an absolute number one destination for tons of transfer quarterbacks
right.
and guys in high school coming up. And
which it had not been for about 23 years, right?
No, definitely not. Those things kind of clash too. You know, you take in potentially, we got Sam Levitt from Arizona State potentially visiting very soon. Those things kind of clash with some high school recruits. They look at that and they think,
right.
am I ever going to see the field?
Right.
But I think now with Cam Ward being the number one overall pick, that kind of just absolutely boosting him up.
Yeah.
And then Carson Beck has kind of rewrote his legacy in college.
What?
I don't know what's going to happen in the spring, but I know it's a lot better of an outlook than it was last spring.
Right.
I think as far as the future is concerned,
what?
You gotta, your managers, yeah. if you're one of these quarterbacks looking for an NIL deal, they're telling you go down south, go to South Florida.
What, Patrick, though, do you and other sports writers believe is the real factor or factors that have brought the University of Miami back to the college football mountaintop, as it were, that it owned for so long there at the end of the 20th century? Is it just the new coach, Mario Cristobal, or is it something bigger?
Well, I would say he's got a lot to do with it for sure. I think that he doesn't throw these overwhelming expectations onto the program. It's the way that he just makes sure that they do something day in and day out. Super cliche, but it's the way that Mario Cristobal is. And he doesn't try to chase the ghosts of the past and make sure that this team always kind of has their lens looking forward. And I would say for him and the staff, Shannon Dawson as the OC, Corey Heatherman as the DC, have been an absolute great tandem this year, kind of all the pieces of fit. And then also when you take a look at Miami, you know, they can afford and spend with just the best of them. I think that that's super important too. And I would say the leadership of some of the veteran guys who kind of have been here for a few years has been super important for this team.
What strikes you most about this team, though? Not just the quarterback, Carson Beck, but top flight receivers like Malachi Toney, who might remind folks of past legends like Michael Irvin, and defensive stars like Reuben Bain Jr., who might remind folks of legends like Ray Lewis. What has brought them to this incredible peak we're seeing them play at in these college football playoffs right now?
Well, I think it's a classic Mario Cristobal built squad. Certainly to be able to run the ball 50 times or 51 times, excuse me, last night, that's unbelievable stuff. And if you are, everybody's been paying attention to high school football in the Miami area, you knew Malachi Toney was the absolute truth. I mean, he's supposed to be a senior in high school right now. So you get those guys. You get Malachi Toney on the offensive side. You get some transfers as well to help out Carson Beck, who himself is also a transfer. And then you've got Reuben Bain bouncing back from a year last year where he was hurt. You have both of those guys kind of leading the way, one younger, one older. And that has just been super pivotal to the way this team plays football. Super complimentary, always playing on their own terms. And I know some people might say sometimes that kind of leads you into a rock fight in a sense. But it's super, super positive for this team.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with Patrick Previty of the Canes Warning site about the long-awaited return to prominence of University of Miami Hurricanes football. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Patrick, I also wanted to ask you about the larger football program culture that also seems to stand out now under Coach Cristobal that I think we have to mention contrasts significantly with the more controversial culture that predominated back in the 1980s and 90s. Back then, UM football had a rather thug, if not criminal, reputation. In fact, whenever Notre Dame played the Hurricanes back then, it was billed as, quote, Catholics versus convicts. And in 1985, Sports Illustrated even urged the university's president to shut the program down because of all that. How different is the program now in that regard? And do you think that change in culture has helped lead it back to prominence on the field?
I think it's one of, if not the most important thing for this program to be under Mario Cristobal and to not say the U is back. He refuses to say it this entire year.
Good point.
And I think that's partially because of that reputation. When we look back at some of the eras that this Miami team has been, it's been 200 miles per hour, go for the moon, the mountaintop, if you will. And it hasn't exactly been the most sustainable way to achieve long-term program success. Uh-huh. And so I think when you have a guy like Mario Cristobal come in, you don't exactly want to try to redo what has worked, even though obviously that's a formula that is something that has shown to be proven, but you want to make sure that you have something long-term. I don't see Mario Cristobal going, you know, anywhere anytime soon. So he's looking at it probably like, what is the way that we can kind of say, hey, we're not ditching the history, but we're acknowledging it, but also that's not exactly what we want to build the foundation on anymore.
Right. So it's a different mindset. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So looking ahead, I was struck by one of your reports in Kane's Warning this week, where you point out that if Oregon defeats Indiana tonight in the other playoff semifinal, we'll be looking at a sort of a Cristobal Bowl on January 19th, because UM coach Mario Cristobal effectively built that Oregon program before he came to the University of Miami. How would you characterize the kind of football he's built at both schools?
Yeah, you know what you're going to get with Mario Cristobal. It's going to be in the trenches to be able to move the other team on the offensive line and the defensive line. And he is going to have his formula, whether or not he was at, you know, when he was at Oregon, did the same thing, and then now at Miami. I think it's super interesting how he just, it's not like a live and die by it, but it's sort of, that is the foundation. That is what we're going to do. And we're not going to back away from that. We saw it in the game against Notre Dame at the week one of this season. And we've seen it all throughout the college football playoff. That is the kind of football that he likes to play. As I mentioned earlier, the 51 runs, and it's just been super pivotal to how he builds the program. And I think it kind of rubs off on like the personality of the programs as well that he's been able to do at both sides. Obviously, right. Oregon is different. They're more, you know, built off of Dan Lanning's culture certainly now. But when you look back at both stints for Cristobal, it's been based off of the line of scrimmage, and he's been able to own it.
Well, we'll have fun on the 19th, that's for sure. Patrick Privity is a site expert for Kane's Warning. Patrick, many thanks. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, man. Thank you for having me.
That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.